Before you have the Dash A11 amendments, we have a group of folks who want to testify. I'll have Paul Warner talk about the amendments to the amendment, the changes, and then we'll go through the testify.
Mr. Chair, on the Dash A11, there's 5 adjustments that are captured in that amendment. The first one is on the first page there under Section 1A. There's a policy statement about uses of the revenues raised from personal income and corporate excise income tax increases in the measure, that they're to be directed for funding of kindergarten through grade 12 public education. The next amendment is on page 6. Which we noticed that going through the earlier draft that there wasn't reference on the phase-out of the elderly medical deduction. There wasn't reference back to joint filers. So this just makes sure that the numbers are listed there for single filers, and then you double that to apply to joint filers. So that's a technical correction. The next change was on page 20. The next change was on page 12, which makes a statutory reference on the itemized deductions that are reduced by 5%. In the Dash 9s, the way it was worded would have included the elderly medical deduction. So it, in effect, would have been hit twice. So that's pulled out so that this 5% reduction applies only to the itemized deductions on the federal return minus the state income taxes. So that's the way that 1DA reads in 316.695. On page 20, there is an exemption on the corporate credit reduction of 20% for affordable housing and farm worker housing. We just needed to add another statute there. It was 315.164. So that's been taken care of there. Now, finally, on page 27, there was concern on the part of the county property tax collectors about a variable rate on discount. So what this does is simply delete the section that would have put in a variable rate tied to the Federal Reserve discount rate. And what this does is reduce the discount to 1%. And which amounts to a 4% annual rate before November 15th, and then leaves it at that. And then if that you need to revisit that in 05, that could be revisited by the 05 session.
Ms. Holt, you've read that section, and it meets the test of... Great, thanks. She nodded for the record.
That's it.
Questions for Mr. Warner? Gordon Foltz, Gina Furman, Bart Murray.
Mr. Chair.
Morning.
Members of the committee, for the record, Gordon Foltz with the Association of Oregon Counties. I just want to give you a little history on the beer and wine tax. 28 years ago, in the old building, your predecessors sat and decided that after reviewing the number of problems that alcohol and drug created throughout our human services and correction system, that we needed to find a way to find additional revenues to address the problem. They basically connected the beer and wine industry and the products with the need for some revenues to address the problem, and they created the nexus. At that point, they passed House Bill 2145, which basically did impose the tax for the first time and dedicated half of that to address alcohol and drug and mental health problems. That formula, 50% going to treatment, and that 50% is divided 40% to counties directly for alcohol and drug services, 40% to the state to be matched to counties with the state approval of the plan that's designed, and then 20% of that is to go for corrections alcohol and drug treatment. The other 50% of that tax that was imposed goes 56% to the state, to the OLCC revenues, and that goes to the state. 34% goes to cities and 10% to counties. I do not think they dedicated the whole amount because they assumed there were expenditures in all three of those governmental units to address alcohol and drug problems. In fact, our association did a study in the 70s to define what was the cost of counties in dealing with alcohol and drug problems. And it went far beyond what you would normally think of in terms of human services, but it went into corrections, went into courts, went into the repair of road facilities because of traffic accidents and others due to alcohol. And we found that at least four times what we were receiving in our OLCC revenues we expended to address these kinds of problems. So that decision was made, and the nexus was created in 1975. 2 years later, in these new wings, first time they were used, the legislature decided to increase that tax because already in that two-year period there had been an inflation occur, and they wanted to make sure that it was current. That was 26 years ago. We have yet to have any kind of increase in that tax, and obviously the amount of problems we're addressing in alcohol and drug has increased. The revenue has decreased. And so we are here today to tell you that there is a need to increase the tax, but there's also a need to dedicate this tax to the problems which it creates, to the problem the product creates, which is the abuse and use of alcohol. And certainly not everybody does that, but there is a percentage, and that percentage causes difficulties that need to be addressed. If you don't address it through this kind of mechanism, then the public has to address it in more costlier mechanisms, i.e. jails, hospitals, emergency rooms, all kinds of things that are much higher cost to the public rather than the part of the solution being the preventive and early intervention services we can get by imposing the tax early. As we look at it, you've got two or three decisions to make. The first is, do you want to continue the nexus that your predecessors created in 1975 between the tax and the uses? We think you should. Secondly, we would say, is the tax accurate for today's market? We would say no, you need to increase it. I think far beyond where you're proposing right now. And at the very minimum, we would suggest whatever it is you increase this tax, you dedicate it to the uses that were intended back in 1975. I do not think that would be too difficult because there are expenditures you're proposing, we understand, are on the list, both mental health and alcohol and drug, that all you need to do is earmark for those purposes. And you will preserve the integrity of the agreement we had in 1975. Rather than just have it as a general fund source to fill a hole. Let me go through a couple other things. You have a couple of packets that I want to take you through very quickly. The first is a packet with my testimony on it that just has some details about the beer and wine tax. It has some justification and some figures and facts that were put together by the Department of Human Services. And it also has the history of liquor control in this state, going back to the time that counties had liquor control in the beginning. And it was done by Ken Tolinar, who is the director of the Bureau of Governmental Research and Service a few years ago at the University of Oregon. The second piece you have is basically a press release package that we put out when there were five legislators who sponsored various beer and wine taxes, and you will see in my testimony I've referred to at least two bills. We've been following the issue around, so you've seen it before, but it does address the same issues. In the press release, you will find information on where we rank in terms of particularly our beer tax, what other states' prices are, comparison. It has information on the impact of abuse. All up to date, I might add. It has as well the polling information in the last several years. Polling that indicates that if you were to dedicate the tax to alcohol and drug treatment and mental health treatment prevention, that there would be a favorable vote for the people. And it's there's three or four versions of that. I think you'll hear referenced another poll that was done. Actually, they'll refer to the measure that was on the ballot a few years ago that had it dedicated to sports, college sports, that did not pass. But the polling indicates that if you dedicate to these purposes, it would pass. So we're comfortable that the public, anyway, endorses this. Also in this packet, you will find information that we put together just a couple of months ago indicating where we were as a mental health and alcohol and drug system today. We pointed out what was missing after five special sessions and rebalances and November e-board actions in our alcohol and drug and mental health systems, and what was needed to preserve at least the basic infrastructure. And you will note that on page there, not too far, well, about two-thirds of the way through the packet. Then you will note, and you've heard this number before, the survey we did on how many employees have been lost in that treatment system, both public employees and nonprofit employees who deliver the services, over 1,800 of them, and the county-by-county breakdown is there. Of that number, over 1,800 family wage jobs, we figure that at least 70%, 75 or 80% actually, of those people were clinicians. Each clinician seeing roughly 70 persons, clients per month. That's the capacity that we've lost in our system. So we can easily demonstrate the need and be glad to do so if you need more information. But then the other material you have here basically outlines county by county what each county is trying to do, not only in this biennium, but what they're anticipating next biennium if they have no additional revenues. So, Mr. Chairman, this right now, in terms of that split between on the existing beer and wine, the amount generated in the existing 50% beer tax roughly is $24 million. That's total, 12 of which comes into our treatment system. And under that 40-40-20 that I outlined a moment ago, 40% comes directly to counties, roughly $5 million, another 5 available for match by the state. That's what we have in the system today. And it's been there for some years at that percentage. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate all your work you've done on this, Mr. Foltz. Ms. Berman?
Thank you. Chair Deckert, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Furman. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. In the last 17 months, we have laid off over 1,800 mental health and addiction workers in all 36 counties due to budget cuts. Those are family wage jobs. That means over 50,000 people that have been receiving mental health and addiction services are not receiving them or finding other ways to receive services, such as more expensive hospital stays and public safety systems. We have been operating since February 1st of this year on zero crisis dollars. Many counties are draining their operating reserve or discontinuing other services and transferring money into crisis. Some have cut off their crisis systems altogether, and this won't be able to continue much longer. All non-Medicaid adult mental health treatment money has been cut. All supported employment and housing money in the general fund have been cut, and alcohol and drug treatment has been eliminated for almost 50% of our most neediest Oregonians. You asked us not to come to you with a problem unless we came to you with a solution. You contract with counties to provide mental health and addiction services for Oregonians that have little or no health care or simply cannot afford these much-needed services. We want to thank the senator and representatives that came up with the beer tax idea dedicated, and we would ask that part of House Bill 2152, that you take the consumption tax and dedicate it to mental health and addiction services and treatment services. Would ask you to do that.
Thank you.
Chair Decker, members of the committee, I'm Bart Murray. I'm the director of a treatment program in Baker City, Oregon. We provide both regional and statewide residential corrections and outpatient programs. I wanted to take just a few minutes of your time to talk about how that impact is on more of a local level. One of the main drivers of problems in social service and Department of Human Resources is alcohol and drug use. And we see that a lot in our corrections programs, which we provide in three different state correctional facilities, that one of the main things the Department of Corrections estimates that 75% to 80% of all the inmates there are partially there or directly there because of alcohol and drug consumption. We see that in our residential programs, both for youth that we run and in the adult and in our women and children's program. I want to talk directly to you about our women and children's program. We're very proud of that. We have 10 beds, and we have the capacity for 10 women and 10 children. We did have 15 beds, but we had a reduction of 6 beds during the cuts that went during the special session. In our area in eastern Oregon and throughout the state, there's been an increase in the number of children that are in protective care. It's very costly when children are not able to get back with their families and they end up being placed under the directions and care of the state and having to find new families. It's very disruptive for the family and the child and the cost to us. We've had 6 babies born this last year that were born drug-free, and those people who are not in treatment, who are pregnant and still using, many times we get babies that have been drug affected, and some it's temporary for a few months or years, and some is permanent damage. And the cost is tremendous when you think about caring for a small child who may have permanent damage because of the mother's use of alcohol and drugs. It's imperative, I believe, that we look at restoring the cuts that have happened. We've had tremendous cuts throughout the state. I'm not aware of any plan to restore those cuts except for what was mentioned about the possibility of increasing the beer tax, the beer and wine tax, and using that money for treatment. It makes a big difference because I know you hear this all the time, and I know we're in tough times, but when we cut the services for the people that need that, in the long run, it will cost us more. And it costs more in human suffering and costs more to us as taxpayers. I think it's wrong to take this tax and to use it in any way except for treatment. I just think it's wrong. I know we have tough choices to make, but please think about the people that's going to be impacted, they're currently impacted. We have waiting lists. People can't get into treatment. We need your support. I'm glad you're talking about a beer tax because for years no one has been willing to bite that bullet. You have the opportunity to do that, but please dedicate it to treatment. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I was going to ask yesterday, there's the existing beer tax now, and Gordon, you went through all these things. Does all of the beer tax money now go to treatment programs, or does some of that money actually end up in general fund projects?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, half of the existing beer tax, beer and wine tax, goes to treatment programs, as I outlined. That's the 40-40-20. The other half joins the general funds of the state, 56%, cities, 34%, and counties, 10%. The assumption made in 75 was that there were expenditures out of those general funds addressing alcohol and drug problems, and therefore that's why the money was shifted over to that area.
Okay, so some of it is used in general funds.
Some of it is used in general funds, that's correct.
I understand the counties and the cities are both in the same situation and trying to obtain, funds to keep their programs going. But, if it seems like there's a nexus, why is that money going into general funds? All that money that's existing now should be going into programs. That would take care of your problem, it seems to me.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, again, the study that we did in the 70s indicated that even with the tax we were giving to address the treatment problems, the county expenditures to address other kinds of problems was far exceeding what we were getting in the way of revenues from the county general fund. We're still addressing that problem. It may not be as direct as having the tax go in there, but I can guarantee you the amount of expenditures that counties make in human services and corrections to address problems related to it is extensive.
Okay. I think that's And I did have another question. It kind of has nothing to do with beer tax, but somebody else brought up another issue. Can I just ask him? There was an issue brought up to me is that this doesn't have to do with the beer tax, but it has to do with the collection of the discount on the property tax. The county's viewpoint is that, say you had a local option, and that was part of your property tax, and it's discounted, but then we take away the discount and take it to the state, are we causing a problem, a legal problem, by transferring the money that maybe a local voter voted on and sending it to the state? Has that issue ever been brought up to you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I think I'm going to let Gil Riddell answer that question. That's in his area of expertise.
Somebody just brought that issue to me, and I just thought I should put that on the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, you raise an issue, and it would be, I think it's something that the legislature and its deliberations need to consider, that if you're potentially diverting money from the property tax system to the state for general fund purposes, there may be a taxpayer who would raise a question about whether that creates some constitutional difficulties. And there may be a lawsuit, and the result is we may have to go through a refund procedure, sort of unscramble the egg. That's a potential. It's not. I don't anticipate, in fact, I'd be shocked if any public jurisdictions sued or threatened a lawsuit. But I think there's the potential with the recent Shiloh Inn case on urban renewal, where you had a citizen file successfully about where the urban renewal monies were being directed, that the same potential exists here.
Thank you. Just want to put that on there.
Yeah. Mr. Chair? Senator Ringo. I just had a question for Gina Furman. You said 1,800 mental health workers have been laid off.
Is that a good one?
Senator Deckert, Senator Ringo, that's correct. 1,800 mental health and addiction workers, about 900 in each.
Okay, and were laid off over what period of time? That's the last 2 years?
Over the last 17 months, since the reduction in addictions money, February 2002.
Okay. And were those workers employed in every county in the state?
Every county, all 36 counties.
Have you looked at what that has done to the economies in the rural communities to have lost those jobs?
Well, we don't have any statistics right now because we're still going through that, but I can tell you that it has been devastating. I have been working with a number of counties that the rest of the frontline workers that are there that are trying to cover part of the caseload are pretty devastating. In fact, as soon as the legislature is out, I'm going to go make visits to try to assess the damage.
Mm-hmm. Let's say you have a mental health worker employed in a rural community and that mental health worker is laid off. I mean, what does that person do for employment? I mean, is there...
They don't. They have to go elsewhere.
Do they move out of town, or do they just stay there unemployed?
Well, we've had both cases. We've had several mental health and addictions workers move out of town, move out of state, because there is no other work for them in smaller communities. We have some that go to work in other venues. I have a mental health director that is getting laid off because they're trying to figure out what they're going to do, and she said that she'll probably go to work part-time in the grocery store there and make substantially less, but their family is rooted there. She has no other options. They're selling their home and renting.
What community is this?
That would be Curry County.
Curry County. Thank you.
Mr. Murray.
Chair Decker, Senator Ringel, in our area, we've laid off 17 people at our agency. And in Baker City and Baker County, we have a very high rate of unemployment. Maybe not the highest, but one of the highest in that area. And because of the lack of jobs, it's very difficult for people to find other employment. It has a significant impact on the little communities when they lose that number of people.
Thank you.
Chair Decker, if I might just add one more piece. That Tolinar study I referred to earlier that you have in your attachment, I would encourage you to take a look at that. That does have the history of liquor control, Once again, counties and cities receive revenue per agreements by previous legislatures on the basis of relinquishing their control over the regulation of liquor as they do video lottery. It was the same kind of agreements, and that talks about the history of that, and you might want to take a look at it. Thank you.
Appreciate Mr. Murray, your driving.
Thank you.
A great distance to be with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Steve Harris, you didn't drive quite. You drove the same drive I did from Beaverton. John Fletcher and Ann. I'm going to get your last name wrong. Ann
Uhler.
I apologize.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Deckard and members of the committee for the time to speak with you today. For the record, my name is Steve Harris, and I'm from Beaverton. I've been active for more than a year contacting many of you as a citizen concerned for those that don't have a voice in Salem and are in need of alcohol and drug addiction treatment. When I went to treatment in 1988, a phone call was made for me, and I walked in 3 hours later because I had money and insurance. I later learned that someone had been bumped because they didn't have money or insurance. And I'm here for that person, and I'm here for thousands of men and women who can't afford treatment or mental health services. It's the least that I can do after my life has been so dramatically changed since I've become sober. My understanding is that yesterday the beer tax, proposed beer tax, was gutted. In exchange for treatment dollars, the beer tax funds would now provide dollars to the general fund for 3 years, and then that money would be used to promote breweries in Oregon for the next year. Let me say, I'm not opposed to microbrews and the attention they've gained. In fact, they're an asset just like any other business. However, I'm sure that the recent automobile licensing tax increase will not go toward promoting the independent gasoline marketers of our state. Those funds will go for repair and maintenance of our roads. I'm aware of how powerful the beer lobby is in this state and across the nation, and the changes yesterday appear to help the local microbrewers who sell a fraction of the beer the big three do, Budweiser, Coors, and Miller. And really, those changes are nothing more than an illusion to satisfy these giants. And, if they were really good citizens, I would suspect that they would be in favor of anything that would help the citizens of Oregon. In a recent hearing in the House, a co-owner of an Oregon microbeer stated that he's waiting to find out if the beer tax is increased to decide if 6 employees go from temporary to permanent status. And I'd ask you to consider the numbers that you've just heard about the people that have been laid off and the lives that have been affected. Jobs in this state, for those 6 jobs, this funding could provide over 994 more taxpayers employed for those 6 people that would probably still, with the increase in those in their business, still be employed. And I'm really wondering, do the brewers need the promotion money that bad? I don't think that they do. You've got a lot of numbers, and I'll real briefly in my next paragraph. There's an article that I've put in my packet from the 2002 State Legislature magazine entitled Conviction for Addiction, and a letter from the mayor of Beaverton in favor of the beer tax, and a Q&A on the beer tax with a lot of information. This state has found that for every dollar spent on treatment, over $5 is saved. And according to the state of Oregon Mental Health and Addiction Services, over 375,000 Oregonians need treatment. Less than 25% receive it. And as you've also heard, over 70% in many surveys, Oregonians favor an increase in the beer tax to support treatment. What the beer tax does is originally written in bills such as House Bill 2837 is provide funds to operate treatment and mental health services to a system that is already in place. The system does not need to be invented. It just needs to be funded. Hooper Detox Center in Portland was named after the last person to die in a Portland jail detoxing off of alcohol. Did you know that you can die from detoxing from alcohol? You won't die coming off of heroin or meth. You'll get real sick, but you won't die. DePaul Treatment Center is no fancy hotel, yet there's a long waiting list of people trying to get in. Mountaindale is one of the few places women can go through treatment with their children. It is in an undisclosed location for their safety. All these centers struggle every day to provide the very best service on the most modest of budgets. The beer industry spends $1 billion to advertise their product. Alcoholism and addiction cost Oregonians hundreds of millions of dollars, somewhere around $685 million. Uncountable dreams are gone, families torn apart, and lives lost from the effects of alcohol and other drugs. Our prisons are crowded with alcohol and drug-related crime. Children are abandoned because of their parents' addiction to alcohol and drugs. Innocent people are buried because of drunk drivers. It makes me sick that we even have to have this conversation today. No matter what the source, we cannot abandon these people that need services in order to promote any product. These services require dependable funding that an increase in the beer tax provides. I urge you to fight for the increase in the beer tax to provide treatment and mental health services this session. And Senator Nelson, I'd like to thank you for recognizing that this does not nearly cover the need that we have in this state. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Questions?
Thank you, Senator Deckert. I'm John Fletcher. I'm with the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. I'm a policy analyst and legislative coordinator for the department. And I'm representing Bob Repine and Jack Kenney, who were unable to be here today. And I just want to make this very brief. The department wants to thank the committee for inclusion in the Dash 11s of a few of the statutes that were mentioned by Mr. Warner. On page 20, line 16, and on page 21, line 4, it lists the exemptions to the 20% deferral to include the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit and also the Farm Worker Tax Credit. The Dash 9s didn't fully exclude the Farm Worker Tax Credit, so the Dash 11s now include those additional statute references so that that is included. And we're very appreciative that these references are now in the Dash 11s. I don't want to spend too much of your time to emphasize the importance of the Affordable Housing Tax Credit or Farm Worker. We have program people here if you'd like to explore that a little further. But to be very brief, it's essential to continue these programs. These programs are using the credit on existing projects. They create the financing with very tight margins, and the credit is part of that financing. And to lose even a portion of that disrupts those projects greatly and causes a lot of problems for the lenders, for the owners, and for tenants who ultimately bear the brunt of those increases. So we could spend more time on it if you'd like to, but we just wanted to thank you very much and urge adoption of the Dash 11s with those additional statute references. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Hoover?
Senator Deckert, say your name right, and other committee members, thank you for an opportunity this morning to talk with you. I am Ann Uhler. I am here today representing the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Problems. Mike Durgan, who is the president, and from Baker City, and Sharon Kelly from Depot Bay were unable to get here this morning. And although I'm one of the newer members of the council, asked me if I would at least come and say a few words around the beer and wine tax proposals that are in your budget today. And given that I've spent 30 years of my life working in the alcohol and drug field, and 16 of those working towards trying to increase the beer and wine tax, I think I can fill in for them adequately. but not probably nearly as well as they might if they were here themselves. Two things that I wanted to talk with you about. One is, and just a little background about what the Governor's Council does so that you understand why we're so concerned about this, is that by statute, the Governor's Council is to hear from many state agencies every 2 years about what's the impact of alcohol and drug on all of these state agencies. And then, based on that, we're to come up with a plan, a biennial plan, about what to do about alcohol and drug problems. So that's, by statute, what we're supposed to do. And so over the last 2 years, we have been hearing, the council has traveled across the state and have heard testimony, eloquent testimony, just like you've heard from Steve and from Bart earlier, about the impact of drug and alcohol use has on communities and families across the state. And recently, of course, with all the cutbacks that have happened this last year, in our monthly meetings, every month we have someone come forward and talk about the impact of the cuts that the legislature made and what impact that's having on programs and on the thousands of individuals who cannot get service. Remember in March when it was decided to take folks off of to remove their benefit for alcohol and drug treatment, that at least 3,000 people, March 1st, had to walk out of the doors of treatment. 3,000 people, because of that decision, suddenly didn't get services anymore. So you can imagine what kind of information started coming our way when we heard about deaths because of that, when we heard about the increased number of children who now have to stay in foster care because of the law that says that women who have their children taken away and if they have a drug and alcohol problem can't get them back unless they get alcohol and drug treatment. Well, they no longer could get that treatment. So now we've heard recent testimony from the Women's Commission that it's going to cost the state $25 million more this biennium in foster care, because those women cannot get treatment. Okay, so that's just one example that we've been hearing about the effects of the removal and loss of services over this last year. So we are here. I'm here to talk with you about policy, good policy. We have supported, the council has supported, increasing the beer and wine tax for a number of years, as long as it goes to directly support treatment and prevention. And so what we'd like you to do is a little tweaking in your plan here, and just tweak it so that it goes back to the way it's always been, and that is the increase goes to the old formula. That's not very much, and I don't think that's very hard to do. So if you can just make that tweak. Three reasons for that good policy and why the Governor's Council. So I want to reiterate. It directly helps thousands of individuals. It is a good investment. You heard it. For every $1 you put in treatment, you're going to get from $5 to $7 expenses reduced in all of those state agencies. I mean, in today's market, as an investment, how can you pass that one up? The third reason for good policy is that the majority of voters will support this. You're here representing the voters, the people of Oregon. I can give you a list of surveys over the last 2 years that at least 71% of the people of Oregon will support this tax if it goes to alcohol and drug treatment. If we tried once to pass it and it didn't go, that was for a stadium or something, for
college sports.
It didn't get passed then. You know, voters are not dumb. They get the connection. between use and the need to rehabilitate. So they'll vote for it. So that's good policy in my mind. All right. So those are three good reasons. The last thing is this issue about the beer marketing fund. And frankly, I've thought, even woke up several times in the night trying to find a word that I thought would be okay to use in front of you about how strongly I feel about the only word that I think is okay is it's outrageous. It's absolutely outrageous to take money to promote a product that causes such devastation in this state. You know, 40 years I've been working in the political world, and I know that money talks. And so I'm not naive. But this one is a topper. And I haven't heard one that tops this one. So the council, myself, and on behalf of many of the folks who are devastated, please do not use this tax money to promote the very product that causes all these problems. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ann. Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Ulmer, we have a wine promotion board, and I would assume you feel the same outrage at that board as that you do this, the promotion boards at this
one.
Yes,
and if we had such, maybe we, do we have such a thing for the distilled spirits? You know, and given that the government's already in that business, the policy around that, I think that's just outrageous policy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Kimball, Ms. Zimmer, Mr. Stephen.
Loaiza.
We have a floor session coming up, so if possible, understanding that you feel you've worked very hard on this.
Chair Deckard and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm with the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill of Oregon. And as this is a new committee for me, I'd like to add that I'm the parent of two boys, one of whom is a 16-year-old with bipolar disorder. And in working with NAMI, I hear and I carry in my heart hundreds of stories of people who've been devastated by mental illness in their family, like Carla, who lives in the Salem area and whose ex-husband was on the medically needy program. And when that program for mental health medications ended this spring, he went off his medications and weeks later was found in a park in this area, dehydrated, dirty, starving, and paranoid. They found him and took him to a hospital. And this story sticks in my heart because she has a son the age of my youngest son, a son who made her stop telling her story because he was upset and needed his mother. He was worried about his dad. But disturbing as those stories are, they rather pale in comparison to the calls I've been getting of late. Suicides, children in state custody, and two last week from parents whose children, young adults now, have been sent to jail for crimes committed when they were unmedicated, untreated, the victims of a mental health and addiction system that has abandoned them for the lack of funds. So at a much higher cost and an incalculable cost to families, we are criminalizing those who suffer from treatable illnesses. And for those who don't end up in jail or prison, there's always the state hospital system. And every day I drive past those state hospital buildings on my way home to Portland. Those dilapidated relics speak to a past where mental illness was treated little better than a heinous crime, They are anachronistic, they are frightening, and they are symbolic of our neglect of mental illness. And after I drive past them, I go home, and daily I see the face of mental illness. It is in my son. He is stable, he's talented, he's hardworking. He has a life before him. But life will always contain a struggle for him. And without medication, without job and housing supports, and the therapies he needs, what will his life look like? Will it be life working and living the way we all expect our children to live, with friends, family, a job, place to call home? Or will it be our state prison system or our state hospital system? He, like thousands in our state, have the potential and every right to recovery. But without a commitment and an investment in community mental health and addiction services, I shudder to think what their future holds. Yet you have before you a beer tax which, unlike previous proposals, would not send a penny to direct community mental health, addictions, and public safety programs. Instead, those funds would disappear into the general fund and almost unbelievably would actually send the fourth year's proceeds to a fund for the marketing and promotion of malt beverages. This is just too bitter to swallow. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jacqueline Zimmer. I'm the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. We're a human services-based organization that believes that we would prefer not to be pitted against each other. We will not go after each other's programs. We think that all human services programs should be adequately funded. And to that end, I have provided you with a document we've created that reads Human Services Budget Survey. And in this document are about $126 million of human services programs that were not funded in House Bill 5030, the House Budget Committee or Human Services Budget Committee that came to you. And I understand that later on this morning, the Budget Committee in the Senate side will be meeting to review and pass out the Senate version of the Human Services Budget Bill. So we'll want you to be well-versed in what it is that you're voting for and not voting for when that budget comes to you, and I would encourage you to take a moment, perhaps when you're on the floor this morning, and read through this document and share it with your coworkers. Every member of the legislature has a copy of this, and if you know somebody who would like a copy of it, let us know. And in the interest of time, so I'm going to jump on into some other things. I'm also the director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and we essentially are the in-home care people, but we do provide services to seniors and people with disabilities who are 18 to 65 throughout the state of Oregon. And we're here this morning to talk about a couple of different things to you. One, the concept of reducing the senior medical tax deduction that's before you for $42 million annually. We're a little, outraged is an all right word to use here. That's $42 million that you're considering taking from seniors who have high medical expenses, and we understand the logic behind that. What we don't understand is why none of that is being applied toward reinstating programs for seniors and people with disabilities, and we would encourage you to direct some of that money to our programs. And keep in mind that most of what you give to human services programs will be matched either on a 40-60, could be an even higher federal matching rate. So we have very little money left in Oregon Project Independence, which is a program that kept about 4,000 seniors in their own home. There is very little funding available for the Medicaid clients who are in levels 1 through 17. Our understanding is that levels up to 13 will be reinstated on the Senate side, but that leaves about 5,000 seniors and people with disabilities at levels 14, 15, 16, and 17. And those Medicaid clients are actually trying to get onto Oregon Project Independence. I mean, they're looking for somewhere to get some support so that they can remain in their own homes. And Oregon Project Independence is limited to seniors only. So people with disabilities can't access Oregon Project Independence. That's why it's so important for you to reinstate funding to both of those programs at the highest level possible.
Jacqueline, you know that we can't do that in the Revenue Committee.
No, but I'm suggesting to you that one of the things that you do is, Mr. Chair, is to consider if you're going to take a $42 million reduction in the senior medical expense program that you turn around and dedicate at least some of it to senior programs. I think that helps with the spin of taking funding away from seniors who have more resources by giving it to folks who don't have as many resources or who have already spent through all of their resources. So that's something that we're encouraging you to do today if you're going to take that deduction. And same goes for the medically needy program. So we're just asking you to consider, like others before us, actually dedicating funding to programs where there's a nexus that makes sense and we think it's more defensible for you. So, and then the other thing that we wanted to mention is that on the beer and wine tax, we understand the industry's issues with this. We would hope that if you were to go ahead with that you would in fact dedicate that to programs that help people who actually have those health issues. There are a significant number of seniors and people with disabilities who quite frankly self-medicate using alcohol and the combination of drugs, those that can still get any. And so that's a good place to put that money if you're going to do that. And finally, we understand the beer marketing concept. We see that it has a sunset date of 2007. The wine industry, I believe, gets its money sort of ongoing for their marketing. And at some point, we think that that industry is probably on its feet, just like the beer industry is probably on its feet, essentially. And I think the idea of sunsetting that is appropriate. So I will limit my comments and contact each one of you directly rather than taking up your time here today. Thank you.
Good question, Mr. Chair. Do you have amendments? Are you having amendments proposed that
would
solve some of these problems that you're talking about?
About the dedication of funding? We're working on that.
And on both of them. And your issue is that the fund should be dedicated also. Are there amendments proposed now, or do we have those in front of us, or they don't?
No, you don't, but we're working on those. Thank you.
Senator Nelson, just on that point, we were in the negotiations. The Ways and Means basically gave us a bill to fund. Our committee was not charged with dedicating the resources. We were given a number that we had to come up with to balance the budgets. Any adjustments that we make, and we're certainly contemplating some, will just have to come out of those budgets. I mean, that's just the dire reality that we face, is that we were given a number to fund to, and this is what funds to that level.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Senator Deckert, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Lewise. I'm Executive Director of NAMI Oregon. And I'll keep it short and sweet. Number one, you've heard how widespread alcohol and drug abuse and addiction is. I just want to let you know that the World Health Organization and Harvard Medical School did a study in 1999, and of the 10 leading diseases in the world, alcohol and drug abuse was in that top 10. So it's widespread. It's all around the world. And I want to say on a more personal note, my family has wrestled with alcohol and drug addiction problems. And what I would like to say is that treatment works. But in order to have treatment works, you have to fund the programs that do work. My second point is that traditionally, the DHS has always been underfunded. We have not had the funds that we need to do to provide the services that are required. And so when I saw that this money was going to be going into the general fund, I thought to myself, it's just going to get lost in the general fund, and it's not going to go to the department that really needs it. And on a sidebar, I'd like to say that I like the direction that the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services is going, because it's not only a symbol but a working program of how these are co-occurring disorders. They go hand in glove with one another. Studies show that more than 50% of the people that have a mental illness also have a co-occurring disorder. So we urge you to dedicate these funds where they're needed. Don't let them go into the general fund where they're going to get lost. I thought your question was very germane to what we're doing right here. And then my last point is the marketing and advertising for the malt industry. There have been some very gentle people say they've searched hard and wide to find adequate language to describe their reaction. I can't tell you my reaction, but it is outrageous that we would fund this kind of thing. And I wonder what kind of a message that the state of Oregon is sending people when we're proposing to fund or market or advertise a drug like alcohol. So like to leave you with this message. Treatment works. We need the funding. And don't support the malt liquor industry on this one. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Questions?
Thanks, Steve.
Marcia Kelly. Senator Morissette, I'm sorry. Senator Morissette, I hope you just arrived. Peter Hanley. Did you want to? And Lynn, did your housing? Did you need to? Is your housing issues solved with?
Mine solved.
You guys are already kind of on it. Yes.
I think we understand the farm worker and the affordable housing issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill Morissette, Senator from Senate District 6, Lynn. Lane County. I do have some written comments that I will you will receive, and the bottom line is I think that the beer wine tax is a no-brainer for related illnesses, drug, alcohol treatment. I think it's extremely important. I would urge strongly that you hold out for a 5 cent per drink at least. The cost shift that we are experiencing for those related illnesses will only get worse. Someone is going to have to pay the price. Lane County has put in a unique program of a mental health service center to take people out of the jail. That will save a lot of dollars. That's the beginning of some solutions on treatment. But the traditional funding for the beer wine has gone to the counties for the alcohol treatment, and I think that it should not go into the general fund for general distribution. You at least have to maintain the existing formula for the distribution of any increased beer wine tax, but not to fully fund the programs that are going to end up costing the state much more, I think, is absolutely absurd, ridiculous. So I urge your support. And it dawned on me this morning that my support, I hate to mix issues, but my support for the baseball stadium will hinge on the beer wine tax, because beer wine will be sold in the baseball stadium, and that will collect a lot of money. So I think that... Ooh! Thank you.
A little horse baby.
Ms. Kelly.
Chair Deckard and members of the committee, I'll try to make this very, very brief. My name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition, which is a large umbrella organization, the American Association of University of Women of Oregon, with 3,000-plus members, Delta Kappa Gamma, honorary sorority for current and retired educators with 4,000 members, the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, the Oregon National Association for Women, the Older Women's League, and the Salem YWCA. I've spent 2 years full-time lobbying for the Women's Rights Coalition, lobbying for the Women's Rights Coalition. And when I first came in January of 2001 and started showing up in the Revenue Committee, my good friend Jim Craven, whom I served on the public board with, said, "Marcia, what are you doing in revenue? It's not a women's issue." And I said, "Most certainly, money and funding for state services is a women's issue." So I have closely followed what we are doing with our state money, and I endorse and we endorse your proposals for funding. Means testing is very good, but I do have some real concerns with the latest thing that I see in the Dash 11 amendments. And that's the intent of the legislature to fund kindergarten through K. We know it isn't in the body of the bill, but we also know what people say about legislative intent. They go back to listen to hear what people say on the floor. We are in difficult times, but the human services budget that funds children, adults, and families as just one portion of the human services budget got cut $20 million general fund in the 2001-2003 session. The HISCO list shows somewhere between 48 and 60,000 more in just that area. And funding kindergarten through 12 education does you no good if you have kids who are hungry, who are homeless, who have dysfunctional families. So I don't, although AUW as one organization only lobbied for kindergarten until it, mandatory kindergarten got passed, and it took us over 40 years, I don't believe my organization would support the legislative intent listed in Section 1A. The fabric of a community is very important, and services that you provide through education and through human resources in that community provide jobs, and that spending goes throughout the community. So I'm very supportive of the revenue package, not supportive of that. We need to have revenue to fill not the holes in the DHS budget and the education budget, the craters. We are willing to go forward and support you. I have been educating all of our members the entire session on revenue. They probably are tired of hearing it. But we think that this is a responsible package, and we will support you.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Questions?
You just don't like the statement of policy that these taxes be used for funding K through 12.
I'm concerned that it could be interpreted that the funding is only to go toward K through 12, and it makes no sense to only put money into K through 12 and not into some other human services where children can be supported. The pre-K education classes for some kids, and it just makes no sense, and we would not support a legislative intent to only do that. Now, the good news is that I haven't paid total attention to what has come out with the No Children Left Behind with our education system, but I did run into the fact that in the state of Florida, they only had 400 schools out of 3,000 who made the grade. So we may be in better shape than Florida.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Senator Metzger.
Just a comment, Marcia. And I'm like you. I just read this for the first time this morning as well, and that's just the way things are at this time of the session. But just as a point of fact, as I read this, it's the way it's constructed, and whoever constructed it, it says these are dedicated to K-12 education in sections 1 to 37. It's not the entire funding package. And I did notice that when you got into the human services issues, the beer and wine tax were not included under the K-12 part, only some of these elements. Just as a factual thing, did not relate to the entire bill, and it looks like someone tried to dedicate different sources for other purposes.
I am not just here advocating for the beer and wine taxes for alcohol and drug. I'm advocating for money so that we can have more outreach people to get people food stamps. We now, in this state, get $1 million a day that goes into retail grocery stores from food stamps. We are barely touching the need. We need money for food stamps. That would not come out of the beer and wine taxes. This says corporate and personal income taxes. That's the majority of the package under 2152, and it says K through 12. I'm very concerned about that, and if that remains in the bill, we will actively work to have it come out somehow, some way.
So just a follow-up, just Mr. Chair.
Well, you know, I think I can provide some clarity to this. We have a member who will not vote for the package if that language is not in there. And so
maybe we need to work on that member.
Getting to 18 to craft something that all folks can agree on.
We are very happy to help you work toward getting 18 without having that in there.
I just want to make a clarification, if I could, just so I understand this, because you don't like the dedication. I mean, you don't want the specific dedication because there's a broad array of services. And the only reason I say that is that we've had other people who say they want specific dedications. I mean, they want, for example, the beer and wine tax specifically dedicated to things, and yet there are other services, and you're providing the different point of view that these should be broad-based for a lot of different services. I'm not arguing. I'm just trying to get...
That is correct.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
I think that the more you put silos into funding services, the less you can actually address the real needs, and it's not good public policy to put that many silos.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Kelly. Mr. Schweinhart and Mr. Castagna, you wanted to testify also.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhart, Associate Oregon Industries, for the record, the largest and oldest business association in Oregon. It is very difficult for us at AOI to support the revenue increases in this bill. We understand the need for revenues, although the amount of tax increases in this bill are damaging to our economy. In fact, taxes are the number one deterrent to business growth. House Bill 2152 increases taxes by more than $800 million. It is our position that this is too much to take out of a weakened economy. We also believe there must be agreements to grow our economy with efforts to balance the budget. If not, we will be having these same discussions again in the near future. Business is forecast to decline in the semiconductor industry, transportation industry, construction, and manufacturing. The non-manufacturing and timber industry will grow very little in the near future. Oregon is in pain. Unemployment is still at a national high of 8.1%. We have had the highest unemployment for almost 2 years. State employment data indicates that in the last 12 months, we have lost 2,700 jobs in the computer and electronics industry, 1,400 jobs in the wood products industry, 800 jobs in the primary metals industry, and 2,400 jobs in the non-durable goods industry. Oregon continues to have the weakest economy in the Northwest. Our jobless recovery keeps Oregon in the grips of uncertainty. What is needed to promote a recovery is action by the legislature to push our economy forward. For long-term economic growth, Oregon must remove disincentives to business, such as decreasing the second highest capital gains tax burden. By eliminating this tax, you will create 5,000 plus new jobs in the next biennium. Increasing incentives such as the R&D tax credit to enhance and entice our high-tech and tech industries. Such credits are needed to keep and increase those industries in Oregon. For Oregon to recover, to put Oregonians back to work, and to restructure taxes in the future, the legislature cannot leave this session without a positive impact on business growth. Last week on the House floor, or maybe it was the week before, the K-12 budget bill was predicated on economic growth. Approval of these bills to improve the economy and create jobs is a vote to successfully implement such budgets and increase our tax base. With action by the legislature to improve our economy and hopes of an expanding economy, Oregon can once again become competitive and provide for the needs of Oregonians throughout the state. Remember, we compete with other states and now with other countries. You should not wait for their economies to boost our economies. We need to get Oregon moving forward now. At the close of the 2001-03 regular session of the general fund, the general fund lottery budget was $11.9 billion. Last year, the legislature used five special sessions, tough sessions, to balance the 2001-03 budget. These sessions were needed because tax revenues had fallen off drastically due to our weakened economy. The reality was that we needed to live within our means. We needed to control government spending. And at the close of those five special sessions, the budget was $10.3 billion. A lower $10.3 billion in a recession was necessary. Now, in a weak 2003-2005 economic climate, which shows very little recovery, at best slow recovery, this bill proposes $11.7 billion budget, only $200 billion less than the predicated good times 2001-2003 budget, and a large $1.4 billion higher than the bad times 2001-2003 budget at the close of the fifth special session. Business, as well as the taxpayers, want to know if controlling government spending is still a priority. Taxpayers want to know why we need a large tax increase when they recently rejected a tax surcharge and have made it clear that they want less government spending. Budgets are up, revenues are still down. We need jobs and a recovery, not new taxes. Waiting for the national economy to grow is not the answer to Oregon's problems, either in the long or short term.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate questions. It very much.
Thank you. Questions? Joe, have you guys identified where you'd make the cuts?
We have, on numerous occasions, added to the list of where to make cuts. We've added to the list of where to find new revenues. And what we'd like to see now is, let's do something about the economy. I mean, the tax revenue comes from people working. It comes from that individual income tax. And we're not seeing the growth in that that is really needed to get the revenues in our budget moving. And we can talk about restructuring taxes. We can talk about all that in the future. But right now, we're still there with relying on the individual income tax. And without new jobs, that's not going to grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we can't. We have to go on the forecast that we have. It'd be nice, and Hawaii actually did it, although it's going to be very constitutionally questionable. They just said, give us a better forecast, and pound the shiny die.
I hope the forecast does get better, Mr. Chairman.
I like that. Let's do that.
Mr. Castagna.
Thank you, Chair Deckert. For the record, Bob Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. Thank you for taking this testimony and inviting me up today. I want to raise one issue before the committee. First, I want to thank you and the members of the Senate for trying to raise the revenues necessary to provide for human services and education. Government has an inescapable moral responsibility to provide for those who can't provide for themselves, and maintaining the safety net has been uppermost in our consideration and testimony and advocacy before this session of the legislature. In our advocacy, based upon Catholic social teaching and prioritization in terms of advocacy for the poor, we bring one issue before you in terms of the bill that you have before you today, and that is the issue presenting the personal exemption credit and the reduction by $20 and then the freeze and the phase out. Based upon the information I received this morning from the legislative revenue staff, it appears that for those below $20,000 in income, there is about an $8 million negative impact to those below $20,000 in income, that they would actually wind up paying to the state about $8 million in additional taxes. We would like for you to consider to incorporate the provisions of House Bill 2031 in this bill that provides for the refundability of the earned income tax credit at a 5% level. At a 5% level, that impact is about $6.6 million for the biennium. When you step up to total income of less than $30,000, the impact to that population, those between $0 and $30,000, steps over $15 million in income. So in terms of Catholic social teaching, which asks that those below the poverty level be excused from paying taxes, we have a policy here, at least as it applies to those living in poverty, where we're actually increasing their tax burden. And the state of Oregon already taxes those who are living below poverty. This would exacerbate that by increasing the tax burden for those below poverty. So we would ask you, while you're tweaking this bill and examining this package, to look at the provision in House Bill 2031 and the Earned Income Tax Credit and make it refundable so that we can mitigate the regressivity of the impact of this tax package. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bob. Thank you. Appreciate it. That is all the testimony that we have. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2152, and we will stand in recess.